Good evening, all. I'm Bob C., and I'm a real alcoholic. As Jen shared, I have a home group, which is here, feet first. And I guess I should extend an apology from the speaker who was scheduled, because we do have a list of home group members who are fill-ins for when a speaker can't show up at the last minute, and unfortunately, it tonight, so I do have a sobriety date. It's August 17th, 2006, so I'm just over 8 years here with this group. And when God sees fit to put willing people in my path, I do have the privilege of sharing my experience in these steps with them. And I start off speaking that way because those that have what I want told me that's what I should do, so that is what I do. However, speaking is not one of my favorite parts of service. In fact, if you look at the polls out there for fear, the number one fear for most human beings is the fear of public speaking, followed second by death, which means most people would rather die than come up in front of a bunch of people and speak. However, since AA saved my life, there is nothing that AA asks that I will not try to do if I have it within my power to do so. Here I am. I was also told that it's not very hard to speak. You just show up, share what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, and get out of the way and let God carry the message. So, what was it like? You notice that I introduced myself as a real alcoholic, and I do that because if you had run into me more than 8 years ago, the last thing I would have told you is that I was an alcoholic. In fact, I would have gone to great lengths, great debate, to prove to you that I wasn't. However, the first sentence of chapter 3 in that book says most of us are unwilling to admit that we are real alcoholics. And because having finally gone through that book and at least partially understood it, everything in that book speaks to alcoholism and alcoholics, and there is almost not a page in that book that I can't relate to in one way, shape, or form. So therefore, I must be a real alcoholic. And I really do believe I was born an alcoholic. I come from a regular, plain old middle-class family. I'm the oldest of four children and had parents who did everything in their power to provide for me and love me and care for me. Growing up, there wasn't really any alcoholism in the family besides mine. So I can't blame any external family issues or environmental issues or anything. And I don't believe that to be the case for anybody. But in my experience, my earliest memories surrounded around fear and a form of insecurity, if you will. Okay, my earliest memories were always worrying about something that was going to happen in the future, or kicking myself over something that happened in the past. I was, you know, we alcoholics, we time travel. Okay, we're either going back in the past or going back in the forward. But one of my earliest memories is showing up that first day of kindergarten, walking into that room full of strange children and a new teacher, and I was terrified. I froze, literally froze at the door. And then again, in the middle of sixth grade, we moved from Philadelphia, where I was born, Frankfurt Hospital. We grew up in just over the border in Cheltenham, so I was a city kid for a while, but then we moved down to Ocean City, New Jersey, where I graduated high school ultimately, and became a beach rat. And the second biggest point of fear there was now entering a brand new school with a whole brand new bunch of people. I did not take my first drink until I was about 15 years old, maybe 16 years old, but the years before that were spent alcoholically. I was restless. I was irritable. I was discontent. I was not comfortable in my own skin. Okay? As I said, many, many nights I'm laying there sleepless, either replaying something in my brain that happened in the past and how I could have done something different to make the result more to my liking. Or, more likely, I'm projecting the next day, next week, next year, my whole life out into the future and all the things that could possibly go wrong and, you know, the failures that awaited me, okay? Not sure why that is, but I hear many, many people from this podium say the same thing, and I can relate to that. So how did I deal with that before the first drink? Well, I tried, for the most part, I isolated and escaped into my own mind when I was provided the opportunity. Typically, if I wasn't at school or had to be out in public, I would most likely be found up in my room reading a comic book and escaping into that fantasy world, you know, projecting myself as the hero, or sometimes the villain, to a fault, okay, where my parents were getting worried about me, and they actually sent me to a kiddie shrink to find out why I was so unsocial. So that was unwanted attention, and that caused undue anxiety. So I want to say early in my elementary career, it was like, okay, we got to play a balancing act here. And it was something that served me well in future years. But then I call it being a chameleon. When I was forced to be in public, or when I forced myself to go out in public and play with my so-called friends, I would be whatever you wanted me, or whatever I thought you wanted me to be. Okay, so there would be no tension. Okay? I don't want you telling me I'm wrong. I don't want you to not like me. I just want to get through this as painlessly as possible, and in fact, if you just smile at me and go talk to somebody else, that would be okay too. And that went on for, as I said, well into high school. I'm going to say I was about 15, 16 years old. And throughout that time, I'm trying to be what everybody wants me to be. With my peers, I tried to avoid you as much as possible. If there's adults in the room, I'm going to gravitate more to the adults, and I'm going to portray the ideal picture for them, which meant, okay, I'm going to be a good student. I'm going to go to church. I'm going to volunteer. I'm going to take part in activities that they're going to find acceptable, because even if I run into some friction with my peers, I can now lean to these adults who think that I'm good, and they can help me kind of keep you away. It was that time that one of these volunteer activities was the local rescue squad. They had a volunteer junior corps where you got to dress up in a little jumpsuit and basically hop in the back of the ambulance, and you were the gopher. But I figured at this point, even though I'm totally socially inept, I am starting to realize that there is an opposite sex out there and that it might actually be worth the risk to hang out more with the girls than the guys. The girls were less threatening, actually, but I was scared to death to actually talk to one. But I thought it would be really cool to, you know, every once in a while at the football game, be standing there next to the ambulance in my jumpsuit and what have you. But it was the summer of my 16th year. Now that I remember it, we had a little after summer back to school because some of the membership were college students and they would only work down the shore at the summer, which was our busiest time to augment the staff. We had a party at one of the crew chief's homes that had a fully stocked bar down in the basement, which included a fridge with a tap on it. And because he was cool and wanted to show us that he was a good guy, those of us who were underage were allowed to have a beer, but only two, because I don't want anybody to get into trouble, but you can have two. I had my first one, and let me tell you, I had arrived. That sense of ease and comfort, immediately, the anxiety's gone. For really the first time in my conscious existence, I feel comfortable in my own skin. I can actually look you in the eye. I can even go talk to that girl without shaking or sweating. And just that first beer. And it was gone pretty quick. And then the fear came back. Oh, my God, there's only one more. I mean, at that point, I became a professional drinker because every thought, action, any conscious thought I took from that point on was to make sure I could get to the next drink and that this feeling that I got would never go away anymore. So I drank alcoholically from the very first time because I went back to get my second cup knowing that this guy's kind of counting. Okay, and I'm not going to take any risk trying to sneak a third and call attention to myself. So what I did was reached over and just grabbed the first bottle under the bar that I could find of the stuff that I knew that was stronger. I found out later it was gin, and I found out later that night that I'm allergic to juniper berries when my eyes swelled up. And almost rushed me to the ER because I'm having an asthmatic attack, but I filled up that 12-ounce glass halfway with gin and then topped it off with beer. It tasted horrible. However, it got me where I wanted to be. And from that point on, I literally was chasing the next drink for the next 30-some years. Just to give you an example, the next thing, I'm 16 and I'm now seeking out opportunities to get this thing, okay? Now, granted, there were days in between I was not getting alcohol, but now I knew what I was missing, and that restlessness, that irritability, that discontent, that itching in my skin and that anxiety and that tension would get worse and worse each day that I'm away from that drink. And just motivated me more to try to find where I could get the next one. So I started hanging out with the drinkers and finding the parties. I became much more social, much to my parents' relief. Bob finally came out of his shell. Isn't that wonderful? And so it was for the next 6 to 7 months until I turned the age of 17, which at that time in the state of New Jersey, you got your driver's license, which... this is going to date me, was not a photo ID, was just an old IBM piece of paper punched out on the computer with your birth date. And let me tell you, I looked at that, and we are creative people. Alcoholics are some of the most intelligent people I've ever met. And I looked at that, and I said, 1959, with very little cosmetic surgery, that can become an 8. So a 5.9 became an 8 real quick, and at that time, the legal drinking age in New Jersey was 18. And I immediately became 18. I had my wheels. I had a license. I had arrived. And then that run began. And really, that run for the next 30 years really was just, this is a progressive disease. My drinking would become more frequent, more frequent, more frequent, and I drink alcoholically. I drink to blackout, okay, till I'm consuming amounts where I'm doing stuff I don't remember the next day, and people are coming up and saying, "You okay the next day?" You know, because I'm doing embarrassing stuff. I'm saying bad stuff. You know, I don't know what I did. Okay, I only know the concern people would show to me after I had gone over the line, so to speak, or at least this is how it was in my mind. And then each time I went over the line, I would cut back and rework how to manage my drinking. Okay. So if you can kind of visually look at this, I'm riding a roller coaster ride. Okay. I go up and up, 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 too much, crash. All right. Next time it will be better. Up, 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 crash. Okay, and this roller coaster ride goes up and down and up and down over the next three decades. And it you know, in high school, there were a handful of situations. Okay, all of my consequences, though, were social. Okay, no tickets, no DUIs, no damage, no, you know, just more social embarrassment and behaviors that caused those closest to me a lot of concern. Then comes college. Now I'm away from the authority figures and I could take it to the next level. So much so that fraternity brothers who are drinking almost on a daily basis and basically drinking to passing out every weekend are approaching me about the quantity of alcohol that's now appearing in the, you know, the number of scotch bottles each week in the trash can, okay, the amount of beer consumed on a daily basis. Hey, we just got a new keg. That should have lasted till Friday. It's now Wednesday, and it's empty. Okay. Half of that was probably me. So, okay. I don't have a problem, okay? I'm not an alcoholic, because to me, an alcoholic's a guy who's hiding alcohol, drinking in the morning, okay? You know, I still had the rules at that time. So I'm not drinking until noon, okay? And that's all right, because I was usually sleeping till noon. but, all right. Let's go, and because it was college, it was the 70s, the school was kind of knew there were other substances out there, and if you were discreet in moderation, it was available. So I went on a 3-year marijuana maintenance program, okay, just to show people I'm not drinking. Well, being a real alcoholic, I attacked that just as much, you know, alcoholically as alcohol. And come graduation time, you know, I realized, you know what, my supply is going to dry up. I'm going out into the real world. I'm losing the protection of this academic environment. And at that point, I was consuming so much that cost was becoming prohibitive. So, back to good old reliable. I'll graduate college. The first thing I did was get married, so I had an excuse to get out of my parents' house, and I can continue now to drink the way I could, because, you know, what's Beth's going to say? I'm the one, you know, she's staying at home with the kids. I'm out there as the breadwinner. I should have say on what's going on with my life. And I terrorized her and the children for the next 20 years because the cycle started to escalate. Months became weeks, weeks became days, and so on and so forth until the end. The end came in August of 2006, and that time I had isolated myself from almost every person that I knew. A typical day was I would wake up, I would get a stop at the mini market on the way to work, get a 16-ounce bottle of Coke or Pepsi, drain half of it, reach under the front seat to my brown paper bag wrapped bottle of vodka, top that off, and bring it into the workplace. At lunch, I would go back out and refill. And then I would drive after work. I would go to my local watering hole, the bar I'd been going to for 30 years. You want to talk about Cheers? I walked into that bar and it was, "Hey, Bob, how you doing?" Everybody knew my name. And I loved that place because it was full of alcoholics. Alcoholics who had lost their house, lost their jobs, lost their marriages. I still had a job. I still had my house. I was still married. So I wasn't as bad as they were. They're alcoholic. I'm not. Okay. Silly me. But I would then get my next dose, if you will, there. And because over the years, I had set a timer in my, here's another example of, just as an aside, of my managing my drinking. Because after a bad incident, okay, I've had to call AAA to pull the car out of the ditch at 2 o'clock in the morning on the way home. And how Beth never knew that didn't happen, I don't know. But at any rate, I would tell myself, oh, okay, time to back up. Well, you know what, Bob? You just had too many and you stayed too long, okay? Just three drinks and be out the door by 6. So that works for a while. But then over time, the three singles become three doubles. The three doubles, you know, to a point where, okay, just give me the glass. It was vodka and soda. Just forget the soda. And because I was a 30-year regular at this bar, and I tipped the bartender well, I got what I wanted. Okay, but then I would, after that, be home, and then the bottle that was hidden in the desk in the den would come out, the lights would go off, and I would just lay on the couch and drink in front of the TV until I passed out. At that point, there was no social interaction with my family. They were living in the same house, but I was dead to them, let's put it that way, and I just didn't want to be bothered with the social interaction, okay? Near the end, upon one night, I was staggering up the concrete steps. I must have passed out and fallen down and face first onto the concrete steps, and about, I have no idea how long I laid there, okay? The next day I'm going into work, I've got a scratch here and bruise up here, but I vaguely remember coming to, and there's my wife standing over me, who had for so many times threatened to leave if I came home like that one more time. I can't tell you how many one more times I got away from. She must have the patience of a saint or some insight that I don't know. But I looked up and I said, well, I guess this is it. You're going to kick me out. And she goes, no, I don't have to worry. You keep this up. You'll be dead soon. And she turned around and walked in. And here's how sick I was. It was like, oh, good, she's not going to nag me anymore. Literally, that's what I thought. And it wasn't much longer before I'm sitting at my cubicle at work. It's 11 o'clock in the morning, and there's a... Behind me, I sense a presence. I look over. There's my manager and the HR guy. It's Bob. We'd like you to come with us. And they escort me out of the building into my manager's car. And they said, we think you've been drinking on the job. There have been numerous comments and complaints about your performance, your slurred speech, your personality is different. We think we can smell it on you now. And of course, the first thing is denial. Oh, no, that's probably, I was out a little late last night. Okay, well, we'll see. But they drove me to Grandview. They took blood. And at 11 o'clock, well, I guess it was 11:30 by the time the results came in, I was already at 0.18 at 11 o'clock in the morning. Now, if that isn't a real alcoholic, I don't know what is. So, basically, they said, Bob, okay, here's the thing. You call somebody. We're not going to let you drive. Take you home, and you stay there until we call for you. And I guess it was that night that I actually had a moment of clarity, or I got to that point that Dr. Bob mentions in the book where I had become so desperate that I realized I could not continue doing what I was doing, but I had no idea how I was going to continue living without it. Alcohol had stopped working, and I had no idea on any other solution to my life. And for a long time, I had not prayed to this God other than the foxhole prayers, but I actually called out, heartfelt, desperate, God, I need help. I don't know what to do. Please show me what to do. I'll do whatever it takes, but I can't go on this way. Later on, my sponsor and I talked about this. He says, yeah, you were pretty powerless, weren't you? He says, you probably took a first step, but we're going to go over it again anyway just to make sure. Okay. However, after having done that, I did feel a peace and a calm that I had not felt in quite some time, even with the alcohol. It was more than just that sense of ease and comfort that I got. I almost felt safe and secure, and I had the first good night's sleep that I had ever, that I could remember in the longest time. And the next morning, I woke up, phone rings, Bob, we want you down at Harleysville at HR at 10 o'clock. Okay. And at this time now, I'm numb. And I think in retrospect, I can honestly say that it was because I think I really, that is when, the moment in time that I surrendered my will, because from that point on, I'm kind of walking. And those of you who met me when I first came here to Feet First back in August of 2006, at the deer in the headlights look and the blank stare and just, you know, whatever you say, attitude, which is probably the best place to be. I walked into that HR office not as afraid as I thought I was. going to be, and was basically told, Bob, you know, we don't know what to tell you. We really like you. You're a great worker and a really honest guy, except for when it's about your drinking. So really, we have no choice. You either got to fix that problem or you can no longer be employed here. And I just looked them square in the eye and I said, I understand. I just don't know if I can, and I don't know how. And they said, well, okay, but if you're willing to try, we're here to help. So they gave me the pamphlet. They said they have there's a number here. It was to the Penn Foundation. And then we'd like you to do an outpatient rehab, and let's see how it goes from there. But if you follow the program and you get good marks, you know, there could be a place for you here. And I looked at them honestly and I said, okay, but I've already been there twice and it didn't work. All they're going to do is tell me to go to AA, and I've been to AA and it doesn't work. Okay? Because to be quite honest, I'm a three-peat offender. Okay. The first time I went to Penn Foundation was after our second child was born and my heights or lows, if you will, however you want to call it on the scale, had gotten so bad that was the first time Beth's putting her foot down and saying, you either got to go get help or I'm taking the kids and we're going. So, okay, fine. I didn't want the divorce, okay? Because if I get a divorce, that's one strike against me on the alcoholic category, because I can't lose a marriage. If I lose a marriage, I might be an alcoholic. So, yeah, you're laughing, but you know how that works up here. So I go voluntarily to rehab. And that first, you know, and of course, I'm going to have the therapy sessions where I start to learn the lingo. I start learning about triggers. And, you know, we have some counseling sessions to try to determine, you know, this is where I first got the concept of an alcoholic versus a heavy drinker. And, boy, did I latch onto that. Okay. Oh, that's it. I'm just a heavy drinker. I just got to cut back. And that was the next 20 years. Okay. But as you well know, when you're in therapy, the first thing they recommend is start going to meetings. Go to AA meetings. Now, that's all that the professional therapist told me. I didn't hear anything about sponsors, and I went to the meetings, and I saw these steps on the board, but that was for alcoholics. I mean, that wasn't for me. So I spent 6 to 8 months going to meetings, learning the lingo, learning how to share, learning how to talk recovery, basically how to lie better. Okay, really, that's what I did. I had been going to this one meeting regularly enough that they asked me to be the coffee maker. Oh, cool, yeah, service commitment, yeah. Put another little star on my AA lapel here. Yeah, now I'm in service. And the coffee maker was a great position because I got to show up early, and then quickly the alcoholic brain figured, okay, I could stop off for a quick one or two, you know, use the AA meeting as an excuse to get out of the house, stop at the bar, get a couple, go make the coffee, and then stop at the bar on the way home. And why? Wow, that meeting went late. Oh, no, I'm making coffee now, so I got to, you know, spend extra time cleaning up. That lasted for about 6 weeks before I was politely asked to not show up if I was going to drink because I was setting a bad example. I continued to go to that meeting for another 6 months, although I wasn't going to the meeting. I was telling my wife I was going to the meeting and just spending the whole 2 hours at the bar and then coming home. And you know, she's a smart kid. She figured that out. But then we went through the next cycle of Bob cutting back and rearranging his routine to try to give the impression that he was not drinking. The next low point, high point, was my one and only DUI. That was the second time I was introduced to AA and Penn Foundation and the whole rehab thing. And there, again, I was there because the state was mandating it, so I just did the bare minimum, made the meetings, got my things signed, did what I was told, got all the check marks on the papers done, got my parole, did my ARD, did my community service, and goodbye, AA. So here I am now in intensive outpatient therapy, sitting there scared to death. Because I have been through this. I know what's coming. It didn't work. What am I going to do next? Well, sure enough, they said, okay, part of your requirement is you got to start going to meetings. So 3 meetings a week, and I went. Thank God one of them was feet first. I don't know if the meeting was that different back then than any of the other meetings I had gone to, or what I heard there was being said in every other meeting I've ever been to in my entire life. Okay. And I was just finally willing to listen, or had been beat down enough into a form of sensibleness or senselessness. I did tell you, I was kind of numb. I'm going through this, so I'm just sitting there. Okay. But I heard something there that I'd never heard before, a message of hope, that there might be a solution out there. However, it was going to require me getting a sponsor. No, it's still too scary. And what a sign of weakness, because I had been growing up, I grew up being kind of told and in that culture where big boys don't cry and men take care of their own problems. So asking for help was a sign of weakness. Okay. So I just went to the meetings, but now I'm starting to get nervous again because here's more of the same old. This is not going to work. I'm going to end up losing my job. I'm going to then lose the house. I'm going to blah, blah. I am going to end up being that alcoholic living under the bridge. So we continue through the rehab, and the program progresses. Not only now do I have to go to 3 meetings a week, here it comes. You got to get a sponsor. Now, fortunately, he said, a temporary sponsor. So, okay, temporary. Cool. I think I can handle temporary. That doesn't sound so permanent. Okay. So, in order to maintain employment, and this is really what drove me to raise my hand after 30 years, I said, hi, I'm Bob. I need a temporary sponsor. And they said, well, Bob, if you were paying attention 3 minutes ago, we told you there's a box of their names up here. This is how out of it I was. So out at the smoke break, I still to this day call her the woman that saved my life, came up to me, put my arm around me, and shoved me towards my sponsor and said, there you go. And so there I am, standing in front of this gentleman, now making eye contact. That's what I did. And she comes up behind me and she says, okay, repeat after me. Will you be my sponsor? And he looks at me, and he says, okay, but I'm working with a couple of other guys, and, you know, my time is pretty short. So unless you're willing, I don't want you to waste my time. That scared me. Not only asking him, but the fact that I might now lose him, and I hadn't even started with him. Okay. So, but at that point, that fear drove me, and I don't know if it was willingness or fear, but if that guy told me to go stand in the corner on my head and quack like a duck, I was going to go stand on my head in the corner and quack like a duck. And that was how I entered into the exploration of these steps. And it did not take very long. Okay. In fact, in our first meeting, he says, well, it really does sound like you went through 1, 2, and 3 about a month ago that night. He says, so we'll just review and you share with me again what your experience was, but sounds like we can start working on this. And he hands me a book. And I said, well, what do I do with this? He says, just write down your fears. And I said, well, the only fear I have is losing my job. He said, okay, well, what about your resentments? I said, I don't resent anything. He says, oh, come on. You probably sat for hours bitching in a bar stool and a guy, total stranger, next to you. And he was right. That list was pretty darn long. And after we got 30 or 40 lines on this thing, he says, that's enough, that's enough, that's enough. Because then when we went back down this list on the second column and the third column, I started to see a common thread through all of this stuff, okay? And there was really, everything was driven by fear, okay, as my ego perceived it. Okay, it was, you know, I'm afraid of what you're going to think of me. I'm afraid of losing material things because having those material things will change people's perception of me. The other thing we did with this big book that I had never done before, because I actually had a big book in my possession for most of this 30 years, gathering dust and getting flooded in the basement and what have you. But when I was given that book and I attempted to read it, you skip the Roman numerals, okay? Because that's just superfluous prologues, acknowledgments, what have you. But we walked through the doctor's opinion, and for the first time, I saw an explanation of why I felt the way I did, why I did what I did. And, yeah, okay, I understand now. Drinking isn't the problem. Drinking is my solution. My problem is Bob. I'm the problem. And right now, drinking is the only way to get me out of me. But that stopped working because now the drinking is just adding more problems to my ego because it's ruining that perception of the world of me that I want to be good. My only solution is now making me look bad. So we had to find a replacement for that, and he said, it's very simple. It's a God. Now, the book says, each and every one of us kind of has a understanding of God, and to be perfectly honest with you, I saw God up there on those window shades when I first started coming in to AA, and I said, that's not for me, because I was raised in a fairly conservative, right-wing, evangelical church background, and as far as I was concerned, God was just something other people held up and used as an excuse to bend people to their will. They were nothing but hypocrites and liars. But in reading the big book and seeing up there on the steps for the very first time of your understanding, because I always had this feeling when I was sitting there full of resentment, and yes, the church was about 20 of those 30-some resentments, organized religion out there, was that I always felt that there was a God, but this ain't it. This is in him. The message I'm hearing is that of love and tolerance, and it's not that rock music is bad and that this is bad. It's not a list of rules in black and white. It's more shades of gray and just human interaction. So he says, good, that sounds like a good place to start, and it's kind of a good segue to the rest of this stuff. And I see that I'm running out of time here, so I just quickly want to tell you that what happened is I got me out of me by helping you. Because now life hasn't changed. Life still happens. Life is still full of happenings. But what has changed is my perception and reaction to them. Okay. I also now, instead of looking everything inward and how does it affect Bob, I now look at how do my and your actions affect you. And when I'm making sure that God's kids are taken care of, I'm not inside of me. I'm now out there with you. And instead of being isolated in my room, trying to escape my mind in that fantasy world, I'm now present, not living in the past, not projecting into the future, but I'm here right now with you. And that is one of the greatest gifts that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me, and it's a life back. I mean, A, if I continued drinking the way I did, I would have been dead, okay? But more importantly, I now have a life because I am present. I can now relate to my fellow human beings. I can look at them in the eye, okay? I have a connection. Amends. I did not have very many financial amends, okay? And so I tried to convince my sponsor we could skip over that because I didn't owe anybody any money and there was no damage out there. He says, but Bob, he says, what about the emotional and psychological damage you've done to those closest to you for the last 30 years? Not being the son you should have been, not being the husband you should have been, not being the father you should have been, not being the employee you should have been. I was like, ooh, yeah. So I figure my living amends for principal plus interest will probably carry me well beyond my physical presence on this plane. And so I just continue each and every day. They say you work 1 through 9, and then you live in 10, 11, and 12. I kind of disagree with that because, actually, if I'm doing 10 when I need to, it's really just 1 through 9 express version, okay? And I definitely have a much closer relationship to this higher power, this God of my understanding, that sixth sense that it mentions in the book. That has always been with me. It's been that voice that said, Bob, you better not do that. And I would go ahead and do it anyway. And then that voice was also the one saying, I told you so. Well, rather than rebelling against that voice, I now tend to listen to that voice. And life gets a lot easier when you do that. Also, because I'm an alcoholic, the reason Bob couldn't fix Bob is because he's powerless. I am powerless as an alcoholic. However, if I'm willing to suit up, show up, ask God to show me what he wants me to do every day, his power is available to me for free and for fun each and every day. And that is very freeing. And to be perfectly honest, be of service and help someone out and see that smile come back makes me very happy. I see we're almost at the end of the hour. I would just suggest that if there's anybody out there who is restless, irritable, or discontent, okay, dwelling on mistakes of the past or dreading an unforeseen future, you're in a good place. You're in the right place. And it doesn't have to be that way anymore. Just look for someone who's got what you think you want and just ask them to show you this path. These, in the words of the late, great Tom Flynn, these steps are not hard unless you try to do them yourself. Thank you for your kind attention.